One of the famous Decora eagles, a juvenile known as Four, died as the result of electrocution last week. She's the fourth eagle from Decora to die this way. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. Bob Anderson of the Raptor Resource Project in Decora will also join us. We'll talk about the death of Four and if this death indicates a bigger problem. We'll get an update on the Decora eagles this nesting season. And we'll also talk about the other migrant birds that will be arriving in and moving through Iowa in the coming weeks. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the time of year when many migrant species are on the move, particularly birds. Later this hour, we'll talk about some of the species you might encounter in Iowa this spring, but we're going to start with our highest profile bird in the state, the bald eagle. Yesterday, news broke that another one of the famous Decora eagles has died. A bird known as Four, one of the 2014 offspring, was electrocuted. She's the fourth Decora eagle to die this way. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. He joins us once a month. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
And a man well acquainted with Four and the other Decora eagles, Bob Anderson of the Raptor Resource Project is here. Hello, Bob.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And first of all, tell us what happened to Four.
Well, she left the Decora area, the hatchery area, quite late in the year, and moved to southeastern Iowa for the last almost 2 months, where she must have been flourishing because she hadn't done any wandering at all. And on last Wednesday morning, I received a call that her transmitter was putting out a mortality beep, meaning that there was no movement at all. So I set off Thursday then to go see if I could find the carcass. I knew the satellite transmitter would turn on about 4 o'clock, so I timed my arrival in Harper, Iowa, which was real close to where we were getting the signal, to where I would arrive right about the time that the satellite transmitter turned on. And it only took us about 20 or 30 minutes, and we did find her carcass down below a power pole.
And we've determined that the cause of death is electrocution. Was that obvious right away?
Well, it really wasn't obvious right away. I wanted to do a really detailed inspection of her, and so I waited until Brett Mandernack, who is my collaborator when it comes to eagle research, and Brett has been studying bald eagles for many, many years and written many papers, so I wanted to wait for Brett to arrive on Saturday, and then we carried out kind of a crude autopsy, but a real thorough examination, and we found on her elbow of one of her wings, I think it was her right wing, where there was either an arc entered her body or left her body, because there was kind of a hole in her elbow, and the feathers were singed. So we were pretty convinced that it was an electrocution. And sadly, this is getting to be happening all too often.
Right. She's the fourth of the eagles that you've been following to die in this way.
Correct. Yeah, this pair is ever since we... About 10 years ago, we were filming at the Decora Eagle Camp to make a documentary called The American Eagle. We filmed for 2 years, and then we decided to put it on the Internet. And then a few years ago, it went viral. And as you know, it still continues to be viral. But in the last few years, this particular pair has produced 20 babies, a total of 20. And so we know 4 of the 20 for positive have been electrocuted. And that's what we know of. So it's a... There's probably more, but and there's kind of an outrage. I mean, the public is. I mean, I'm hearing of some petition letters going around the world right now, and I really hope the public can kind of keep level-headed on this, because I know that all the power companies, like Alliant Energy, they're doing everything they can to prevent electrocutions. I mean, nobody wants to kill our national emblem, so as soon as we have a particular problem, the power company in charge fixes it almost immediately. So it's a
So what exactly is the problem? What allows this to happen?
Well, you know, this is my theory. So we're starting to see the bald eagle nest real close to people. We're starting to see, I mean, in some situations they nest, like in the Decoric case, right in Willard Holthouse's backyard. I know bald eagles up in Minnesota now are nesting right on lakes and in people's yards. So the bald eagle is now starting to nest right in close proximity to people. And people have, we have power poles and distribution poles and transmission lines close to us. And these are bad boogeymen for big birds like bald eagles. They really are. Every time a bald eagle lands on a, you know, distribution pole or a power pole, it's almost playing Russian roulette. And a lot of the poles that we have throughout Iowa, a great many of them were actually put up before we even had bald eagles in Iowa.
Right.
So, and there's probably not enough money at Fort Knox to go retrofit every pole in the state of Iowa and put everything underground. So the, usually what's happening now are the particular power companies, if they've got a out-of-code pole, they just fix it immediately and any of the other ones nearby. And the system is working. But I do think that we're going to see increased avian interaction with the electric industry only because the bald eagle population is now moving right to our backyards.
Now, we're very aware of this problem right now because you've been tracking these eagles, and these eagles are so incredibly high profile. So many people are emotionally invested. But, Jim, how often do you think this happens, not just to eagles, but to other large birds?
Well, it certainly, and that's always been a concern, not just electrocution, but actually running into wires. And I'd be interested in Bob's observations about that as well. But certainly running into wires, the large guy wires from big TV towers that are, you know, in various places around big cities have been death traps for birds for a long, long time. And you add to that large skyscrapers that have the estimates. If you look at the estimates that some people have made regarding migrating birds that are killed by tall buildings, well, particularly with those mirrored glass window buildings that we see in some larger cities, it's incredible. It's quite shocking, in fact, and it says something then about the resilience of birds to be able to, you know, put up with that kind of mortality and still do okay. In the case of eagles, it's especially a problem. In part because they are very high-profile birds, but also because of the width of their wings. You know, Bob, talk about what's specific on the pole that causes them. You talked about it being sort of a chance occurrence every time they land on a pole. What is it? Is it the width of the wires, the width of the insulators, the lack of insulation? What is it in specifically that causes the birds to be electrocuted?
Well, it's usually if the bird makes a connection. If they land, they can land on a hot wire,
right,
Jim, and not get electrocuted. But if their wing touches a ground wire while they're on the hot wire,
right,
they complete the circuit and they get zapped.
Right.
So the power lines now are, you know, will keep the ground wire 10 inches down from the very top, and that's considered code within the power distribution
industry. Right.
And but even with the best, I mean, just right a few miles north of me is a brand new power line with state-of-the-art technology for making it, you know, bird safe. And lo and behold, an eagle landed, and it just happened to touch the wrong wires. It, through a freak accident, because it was real windy, maybe a wing shot out or something.
Sure.
And that was an adult eagle that was electrocuted. And then also we've had situations where an eagle will have a long fish in its talons. And if it goes and lands on a pole with a fish, the fish will sometimes touch the ground wire.
Oh, wow.
And that's okay. We've seen that happen several times. So
yeah,
it's a complicated issue. It's not going to be resolved overnight. Eventually, you know, I think all of our power poles and distribution poles will be in code, and hopefully the reduction will be reduced. But the probably the answer to it is put everything underground, but there's probably not enough money in Fort Knox to put all power lines underground.
Yeah.
So, I think now we just need to work with the different power companies and make alterations to every bad pole. We just have to do that. We've got to bring them up to code. We've got to make sure that we can reduce the electrocutions at all whenever possible.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that the power companies, like in this case Alliant and others, have been, for the most part, very, very cooperative and very, as you said, very concerned about that and trying to replace them whenever this happens. And the expansion of the eagle population to nesting in areas, as you say, near human settlement, although in Iowa, there's very little area now that isn't near some sort of human impacted area. Decorah being one of the places in the state where we have a fair bit of wildland around you, but that proximity of birds to cities, I think, increases the problem where we have a greater density, if you will, of power poles.
Allow me just point out one thing which is a recent observation for me. I've been working with birds for about 50 years, but I've noticed over the last few years, and here in Iowa especially, that we now have bald eagles that are building nests right near livestock facilities. They feed on whether or not it be a dead pig or an aborted fetus or whatever. And now we're starting to find nests near livestock facilities where the eagles are absolutely totally dependent upon that industry. Now, I think it's shocking interesting, I should say. We're actually witnessing a bit of evolution or change in behavior, for sure.
Sure.
Because when I was young, I mean, bald eagles nested in northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, along the Mississippi River. And now they're starting to nest in our backyards, and they're starting to adapt to livestock operations. So it's an interesting change in behavior that we're witnessing in our lifetime.
Yeah, I think it's quite fascinating. We've talked about this before on the program, but when I grew up as well, the eagle populations. In fact, we talked in January about the recovery of eagles in Iowa. It's been pretty amazing, to have them nest close, I think it is a really interesting change in behavior. I put out, when I was Extension Wildlife Specialist, I put out a, it was probably the mid-90s, I put out a couple of news releases about this whole idea of of essentially what turned out to be training eagles to depend on dead livestock by putting them out in the fields, and the eagles were actually feeding on them. And I said I recommended people not do that because it did in fact train eagles to become dependent on that food resource. So it's been around for a while, that's for sure. And you're right, now we're seeing them nesting close to livestock facilities. Yeah.
And Bob, could you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Yes.
Okay.
Two more minutes. Okay.
Okay, great. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Bob Anderson of the Raptor Resource Project is here today. Also, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We'll talk about eagles for a little while longer, and then we'll also talk about other migrant birds that you'll have an opportunity to see in the state of Iowa this spring. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Wildlife Day on Talk of Iowa, and wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. Also, Bob Anderson of the Raptor Resource Project. We've been talking about the news that broke yesterday that another one of the Decorah eagles, this one a 2014 offspring known as Four, had been electrocuted and died. This is the fourth Decorah eagle to die this way. And Bob, before I let you go, I have a couple more questions about the eagles to ask you, because there have been a lot of high-profile situations with the Decorah eagles so far this spring, and one of them is that great horned owls had been challenging them for their nest. Has that been resolved?
Well, we think it has been resolved. I mean, there was an actual battle for the nests, and surprisingly, we saw an adult female great horned owl actually knock the adult male eagle right off the nest, which was shocking. I mean, and so we were kind of hoping that the great horned owls would move over to the old nest, and that the bald eagles and the Decorah eagles would keep their new nest.
Right, and then you could watch the bald or the great horned owls too, right?
Right, we had cameras in both nests, so it would have been just fantastic. Possibly, But we did have a shocking thing involving horned owls last year. We have another eagle cam on the Mississippi River near Cassville, Wisconsin, and that's it's been up and running for a couple of years. It doesn't have the following that the Decor Eagle does, but it's a really good high-def camera. And last year, that pair produced two babies, and when the babies were about 3 weeks old, one of them kind of squirreled out from underneath the brooding female in the middle of the night, and a great horned owl came and grabbed it and flew off with it. So in a way, I'm kind of relieved that the owl situation is over with, because I think it might have caused some losses of some of the eaglets this year.
And so the great horned owls seem to have moved off?
They have. We have not seen any sign of them now for about the last 10 days or maybe 2 weeks.
All right. The question arises, though, there have been a lot of people watching these eagles, and nature isn't always kind. Nature isn't always pretty. Bad things happen sometimes. Do you find that because people are so emotionally invested in these animals that they get in touch with you if something goes wrong, asking you to intervene?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've had to remove my phone number and email address from the Internet. I can remember years ago when we first put infrared camera in there that people thought it was an actual spotlight, and I probably had thousands of hate letters, shut that spotlight off. And one time when the babies were snowed on, I mean, there were people demanding that I go up there and put an umbrella over the nest so they don't get so wet and they're so covered in snow. Yes, people are emotionally involved. There's a psychological thing that takes place somewhere between watching, bird cam for 50 hours or 500 hours. You take on a sense of ownership. And our Decor Eagles are owned by a lot of people, and most of those people then think that they can be my boss. So it can be a colorful situation to be in.
Well, it's an interesting lesson as well that, when we watch these animals closely, we learn that there are going to be bad things that happen, and that's happening all over the place. This is just how it works.
Yeah, it's kind of the ultimate reality show. I mean, shocking things take place sometimes. Just sometimes shocking things take place, and sometimes you have to shut a camera off just so people. It's just required. Fortunately, the core birds have been really good parents, and they've always been able to hatch all their eggs and rear all their babies. But now the last few years, they've been plagued with buffalo gnats, black flies, and that's causing quite a problem. I hope we don't have it again this year, because the last 2 years have just been brutal for the young eagles and the adult eagles and peregrine falcons and red-tailed hawks, and a lot of our Iowa wildlife suffered because of black flies over the last couple of years.
Absolutely. Now, a lot of people are on the watch for that first egg. What's your prediction?
Well, I hit 35 days of incubation. It'll probably hatch. Just they always have. So, last year I was so worried because they laid their eggs on a frozen nest and it was 20 below zero, and I really didn't think they would hatch. And this year we never really had that low of temperatures, so I'm breathing a whole lot easier this year. I think everything will be just fine.
All right. Well, Bob, thank you so much for talking with us today. Bob Anderson of the Raptor Resource Project. Of course, it's Wildlife Day on Talk of Iowa. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. And before we move on from eagles, we have Ronald Lindblom on the line from Dubuque. Hello, Ronald.
Hello, Charity.
Hi, thank you so much for giving us a call. And you were among the first to actually research bald eagles in the wild in Iowa?
That's correct. I never met Bob personally, but I've been working with Brett Mandernack, who put those transmitters on his eagles for about 6 years. And we were looking at the impacts of lead on eagles, and that was the first study east of the Rocky Mountains in North America to do that for a wild population.
Well, fascinating. Thank you so much for calling. We were talking about electrocution being a major danger for bald eagles. Lead poisoning also seems to be a major danger for bald eagles.
Yeah, as a footnote, they could be related. We think they are sometimes, because when you're poisoned by lead, if you're not dead, then you're sick and lethargic, and that causes more accidents. So they could be tied at that point.
We were talking earlier about the changing behavior of bald eagles as they move into our cities and live closer to humans. What have you seen in your research?
We've seen this bigger picture, and it really is like a bunch of pieces that are starting to come together. They are opportunistic scavengers. They used to feed on gizzard shad in the rivers, and the next, when the shad went down, or the ice is covering the river, the next easiest thing is barnyard carcasses or deer shot by hunters. They'll actually follow hunters around waiting for the shot. And it's interesting that, so they are very opportunistic. And the bigger question to me is, it reminds me of Chernobyl, where actually wildlife has moved back into the Chernobyl area, and they are highly irradiated. They're getting a lot of radiation. But when you take away all the other stresses, that's actually tolerable in terms of the population. And it's similar for eagles. They are getting hit very hard with a lot of stresses. But we took away DDT, and despite the fact that I'm finding 31% are poisoned every year that are alive, that doesn't count the 60% of clinical admissions which are poisoned by lead. So we're, in other words, we checked live birds. That doesn't count the dead ones. And we've seen the birds fly up to our research station and fall out of the tree. We didn't count those. So we have 31% that are getting exposed to lead every winter. And we have power lines and we have car accidents and everything, and the population is still growing. So it's interesting, once you take away DDT, which absolutely depressed the population, they're withstanding quite a lot of abuse and still growing. To me, that then becomes, okay, are they fine? It's really an ethical question at this point. If anybody watched an eagle get killed, as Bob's cameras illustrate, we respond to what's in front of us and what we know. And it's quite humbling or a little bit difficult to imagine all these combined stresses on them.
And so the lead stress sounds far larger than most of us imagine it to be, but it's invisible to us.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, if you just look at every one out of every three eagles you see is has been poisoned, that doesn't count the dead ones. So maybe it's one out of four and there's one that's dead and you're seeing three and one of those three is also poisoned.
Wow.
Subclinically. So yeah, it's an interesting piece of research, and we're seeing there a lot of these pieces come together, you know, the easier solution is to outlaw lead, which is what they did in California. I hunt with copper bullets myself, and they are fantastic. And, you know, I'm a regular deer hunter, and it's not a technological challenge. It's a sociological challenge to change the lead.
And
change away from lead.
Right. Do you consider this to be the biggest challenge facing bald eagles today in Iowa?
Every researcher will tell you that habitat loss is the biggest problem against any wildlife. But being that they're so opportunistic, that doesn't really seem to be a big issue for them, because they're adaptive and generalist kind of species. They can, they'll nest on in many. They don't need a Yellowstone Park type of place to survive. So after that, yeah, that's primarily. Bob is dealing with young birds. I'm not sure everything he's tracked, but when you have a long-lived species, these don't breed and they only make a few babies a year. They don't start breeding until they're over 5 years old. For a long-lived species, the random removal of individuals has larger impact than for short-lived species. So I don't know. That's kind of mathematical stuff, but for a slow reproducing population, this has a larger effect, as opposed to, imagine frogs that have 1,000 babies every year. They can actually withstand a lot of stress.
Some frogs.
So again, the population's right. Growing, but what did, you know, ethically, if you think about, you know, Google what it looks like when a eagle is being killed by lead, that's maybe the question for us now. Do we really want to think of our eagles going through all that, which they are?
Ron, I can remember several decades ago now canoeing in the Boundary Waters, and there were actually routes that they closed both there and on Isle Royale National Park because of an eagle on a nest, and they didn't want any human disturbance. And yet today, the ones that have you talk about opportunistic, they are now nesting in and around cities all over the Midwest. What do you think, from your observation, has was that flexibility always there, and were we just more protective of them because they were rare, or do you think there's been an actual behavioral change?
Well, I think they had more protection because they were endangered at that point. But but it is something we're learning about all different species, is which ones are tolerant of disturbance and which ones aren't. And we probably just didn't even know.
Right.
Now we do.
Yeah.
some species will not tolerate disturbances, some will. I mean, I was driving the other day, and there was the eagle literally flew up and landed by the back door of the barn of a pig barn, waiting for the cargo to come out.
Yeah.
You know, there they are, the side of the road, everything.
Yeah, it's amazing. Just amazing. Yeah, and that in the long run could be maladaptive. it could be a disadvantage for the birds in the long run. So, and that's always the challenge, I guess. So.
Well, Ronald, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience and your research with us today.
Yes, we just released it at a number of wildlife conferences in the Midwest this spring, or this winter. So it's new research, and maybe it'll be published somewhere soon.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. Ronald Lindblom, who is studying wild bald eagles in Iowa, and we're going to talk about other migratory species for the rest of the hour, but we do have an eagle question before we move along. This is Bonnie on the line from West Branch. Hi, Bonnie.
Good morning.
Hi.
So as you talk about, you know, the various ways that the eagles die, electrocution or by car accidents or whatever, as roadkill, I guess, what would you do if you came upon an eagle carcass? I think that it's illegal to have them or their feathers in your possession.
Yes, it is.
But on the other hand, do Native Americans want those feathers? Is there what would you do if you came upon
an
eagle dead?
Your best bet is to not mess with it at all, and to call the local authorities. That may be a local conservation officer. It may be contacting the local, depending on where you are in the state, it may be easier to contact the county conservation board, who will then contact the conservation officer. But you have to have authorities with the proper permits and proper authorization to even handle them. So don't mess with them in any way, because you may actually be sort of messing up the evidence trail, because some of them are also, as we know, shot illegally, that sort of thing. So you don't want to mess up the potential evidence. So, and that's why earlier in the hour when Bob was talking about going down to find it, he was very careful about going into the area, and he has the proper permitting to do that. But so you contact a local conservation officer, and they will take care of that. So don't handle them at all.
All right, Bonnie, thank you so much for your call. That's also good advice when you come across other dead animals.
Right. Yeah. In fact, the law is it's illegal to possess the feathers or the nests of any North American migratory bird, with the exception of those that are hunted species, waterfowl, grouse, turkeys, that sort of thing. But for those, of course, you have to have a legal hunting license as well. So it may seem excessive, but when you look at the history of what's happened to feathers and humans, it may be totally innocent. I just picked this up on the street. Very likely you did. But there were lots of people in the past that, in fact, it was interesting. The turn of the century, I found this statistic, and I haven't been able to confirm it, but it said that one in every 1,000 Americans in 1901 was engaged in haberdashery, was employed in the haberdashery industry. And I thought, that can't be right. And that was making hats largely with the feathers of birds, and not legally taken birds necessarily at all.
Well, and we look at poaching problems around the world, obviously.
Right,
there,
right.
This is a problem that is still very, very present with us today.
Right, exactly, exactly. So.
Now, we're going to take a short break here in just a minute, Jim, but a lot of people have been watching eagles all winter on the Iowa River in Iowa City. They've been about as common as pigeons in the trees along the Iowa River. They're amazing, but they are starting to disappear. Where are the eagles headed right now? Oh, are you still there?
Here?
There, now I can hear you.
Okay. I don't know what happened there. I sounded weird in my headphones.
And
too.
And we couldn't hear you at all. So
okay.
You know what? Actually, why don't you answer that question after the break?
Okay.
We'll
sounds
be back
good.
In just a moment. I'm talking to wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're going to talk about migratory bird species for the rest of the hour. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about wildlife today on Talk of Iowa with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're going to focus on migratory species for the rest of the hour. And Jim, before the break, when I couldn't hear you, I asked where are the eagles going now? Because they have been so present on the rivers for the winter, but
right.
They are starting to disappear.
Yeah, and what people, since we're talking about migratory species, eagles, in fact, are migratory. Now, of the several thousand that overwinter in Iowa each year, many of those are birds from farther north, from Minnesota, from across Canada, Wisconsin, whatever. They come down here to the warm climate of Iowa, and the warmth is not so much an issue as finding open water. And because we tend to have open water from a variety of reasons, open water below dams, open water around the cooling towers of various kinds of electrical or heating facilities, they take advantage of that where they can get to the fish that are available there. And as we discussed earlier, they also come down because there is the spreading of carcasses, particularly of some of the larger confinement facilities. The piglets that die are often left out in the fields, or put on manure spreaders and put out in the fields by spreading manure. Now, it'll be interesting to see if there is a bill in the State House now that. Whether it passes or not, to prevent the spreading of manure on frozen soil, and that is to protect the our rivers and streams from runoff of that manure. And that would say that those who dispose of their piglets that way by putting them in the manure spreader, that would remove a source of food for some eagles that as we talked about earlier in this hour. So it'll be interesting to see if that gets through. I hope it does, but we'll see. At any rate, the birds are disappearing because now they're going back north. Some eagles that nest in Iowa, and we have about 300 nests, more or less, in Iowa. They're not all active every year. 200 and some seem to be active, and sometimes an eagle pair will shift nests around, and particularly young newly established nests tend to move around a little bit among different areas. And as Bob talked about, sometimes they get challenged by other birds. What I've always called the tiger of the woods, the great horned owls, are even challenging some. It's been quite interesting. So they're 300 or so, either some of whom go farther south for the winter, come back to Iowa, and then but some do apparently stay around through the winter because there are adequate food supplies and open water for them to fish in. But many of the eagles that are here, most of the eagles that are here through the winter, are from farther north and will go back north to nest.
All right. So as the eagles that have been spending the winter here in our balmy Iowa winter head back north, there are a lot of other birds that went further south also making the journey back north. When do we start to see migratory species arrive in Iowa from southern climes?
Today.
Yesterday,
literally
maybe.
Today.
Right, yeah.
It was real interesting. My wife and I spent some time in Florida in the month of February. Boy, did we pick the right time to be gone. Mm-hmm. I kept track of where I started seeing turkey vultures, for example. And on the way down, turkey vultures were in, as far north as central Georgia. But driving back, they were, and I just came back this last weekend on Saturday evening, we saw them in central Illinois. A few, not a lot, but some turkey vultures. And I heard from a friend that here in central Iowa, there were two spotted on Saturday sometime this past weekend.
All right.
So anytime now, you should be seeing turkey vultures. And they take advantage of these weather systems. And we have this strong southern flow of air. Birds, migratory birds, take advantage of those air currents and use it to fly north. So I suspect if you look around, begin to look around, you'll see those TVs, turkey vultures, in their sort of V-shaped wing pattern as they soar out, barely flapping their wings at all in the early mornings over the Iowa River and other rivers in the state of Iowa. So it'd be
interesting. And hopefully eating the things that my dogs have been rolling in.
That's right.
Doing a little cleanup this spring. When you see turkey vultures soaring, how do you identify them as turkey vultures?
Okay.
They have some telltale features.
Yeah. Eagles and most hawks have their wings on the horizontal. Turkey vultures tend to have their wings up in a V shape, not a strong V, but a V shape, so that their wings are upwards. They also tend to have very small heads compared to hawks when you compare it to their bodies, because they're not covered with feathers, so they look smaller, even though they're really the same size. And secondaries and primary feathers tend to look gray from underneath, whereas the leading edge of the wing is black and their whole body is black, but they're that sort of gray primary and secondaries look is tells you right away on that V shape to the wings as they soar. You can identify them very quickly.
All right. Now, a lot of people think that the geese are a sign of spring.
Yeah,
and we hear them and we see them, but
yeah, it used to be that way. But geese have, like eagles, have become very, very adaptable. And it's hard to remember when I was a child growing up in the 60s, 50s, and 60s in southeastern Iowa. We didn't have geese all winter. In fact, there were no giant Canada geese nesting in Iowa, and now they're so common, people don't remember that we lost them at one point. And they're on golf courses everywhere, and they're with us through the winter. And while they will go farther north to nest, this is become a great overwintering spot for them. As long as there's some open water, they tend to stick around.
All right, so we see them moving around. We hear them moving around.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily mean they just got here.
No, it doesn't. No,
but it's lovely. It's lovely to hear them,
right,
and see them.
So. Now, one thing that you can hear, if you go out, particularly in the evenings, and just listen, you may hear several things. You may hear migrating snow geese, which have that goose honk, but it's much higher pitched. And so listen for that, and you'll know snow geese are on the move, and they certainly are already on the move. And along with them, you may, during the daytime, you may see and hear sandhill cranes. They are late March, usually late March, early April, but all bets are off with the strong southern flow of wind and these very warm temperatures that are actually unusual for March. I was hearing weather people, climatologists, saying that there were anywhere from 10 to 15 degrees above normal for these dates in early March. So birds are going to take advantage of that.
It's been unusual, too, because it's been so warm and also not windy or rainy.
Right.
It's certainly pleasant for many species right now, including human beings.
Yeah.
Let's take a couple of calls here. Bob is on the line in Tipton. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, I have a question about turkey vultures.
Sure.
I've seen them sitting on top of, like, telephone poles.
Uh-huh.
With their wings spread way out,
right?
They just sit there.
Right.
What are they doing?
Yeah, that's great. Good observation. And they're sunning is what they're doing. They're sunning themselves, mm-hmm. particularly early in the morning. They will spread their wings and absorb that sunlight. They're a black bird, and so they absorb that sunlight. They're warming up, and they love to sun themselves in that early morning sun. It also, when they get to a certain temperature, it seems like that is a signal to them that there are enough thermals, rising warm air masses from the ground. By that time, as they warm up, so does the ground, that they can actually almost effortlessly put themselves in the air and soar without flapping their wings very much at all. So it's a combination. Let's see, I'm warming up, and so is the ground around me, and there are thermals now rising that so when I'm warm enough, probably the ground is too.
Well, and Bob's talking about seeing them on telephone poles, but you more often see them on the ground doing that, right?
You can see them if you
tend to see them.
Yeah, on the ground or in trees, on rocks if you're over on the river bluffs someplace. Lots of places that they will sun themselves like that.
All right, and I used to pass by a wastewater treatment plant where just dozens and dozens of turkey vultures would sit on the shore of this horrible lagoon and sun themselves in the morning.
Yeah, so, and they probably made use of the lagoon, too, but we don't want to talk about that.
No. All right. They have a really disgusting diet, but it benefits all of us.
Yeah,
so,
it does.
Mitike is on the line next. Hello, Mitike.
Hi. I was a couple weeks ago, we were driving past a farm, and we saw about 20 or 40 bald eagles eating cow meat, and we were wondering if very many farms do that.
Eating carcasses of meat going past a farm, you say?
Yeah, it was in a big black bin, and there's just, like, guts and meat like that.
Yeah. Was this at a rendering plant, or was this at a farm?
No, it was at a farm.
At a farm, yeah. Often there are enclosures around some of the larger confinement facilities in which, because animals do die sometimes as they're at these operations, and so they put them out. Usually it can be a bin, but it's often more of a walled facility. And then a truck comes by on a regular basis from the rendering plant, and then they turn that carcass not into human food, but into all kinds of other things. It may be that the eagles were taking advantage of that. So, yeah, that's interesting. As was mentioned earlier, they're what we call opportunistic, and they will scavenge on roadkill and farm animals that have died as well. So they do scavenge and take advantage of that opportunity to find food.
All right, Mitike, thank you so much for your call. And we were talking earlier about some of the dangers that bald eagles in particular face, and we talked a lot about electrocution and lead. Are these other issues that some of these large migratory bird species also deal with?
Yeah, it is. Eagles and hawks in particular are vulnerable to electrocution because of the width of their wings and the fact that they tend to perch on electrical poles, that sort of thing. But other birds are certainly, large birds in particular, are vulnerable to that if they choose to perch there and if their wings are wide enough. So I really, the sandhill cranes and turkey vultures occasionally get electrocuted. It's because they will perch on an electrical pole and spread their wings and make the circuit complete and do sometimes are subject to it. Sandhill cranes are ground dwellers. They tend not to perch on poles or trees, so that's not a problem with them. Trumpeter swans and white pelicans are two other big migratory birds that we'll see sometime this month or early in April. They'll be coming back. We may be surprised at how quickly they come back. But they, too, tend not to perch on poles. However, these very large birds tend to run into wires of other kinds. I mentioned early in the program these large TV towers that have cables that support them, keep them from blowing over in the wind. And those cables are virtually invisible to birds as they're flying. And the towers here in central Iowa, I know, have been responsible for the, you can always tell when the warbler migrate. Even small birds will run into those guy wires sometimes. And it does happen with large birds as well. Lots of white pelicans sometimes as wires cross rivers, and the pelicans are going up and down the rivers from lake to lake, they will run into those wires as they cross the river. They don't get electrocuted, but it will break a wing. And so these
and
are all
the
hazards.
Same.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And these are all hazards that they certainly can run into. Another large bird are egrets and herons that will be soon, hopefully mid-April, will be coming back to the state as well. So there are lots of big birds, great big birds to watch for, and they run into lots of things. As Bob mentioned, though, habitat loss, particularly of wetlands and woodlands, is a big problem.
The number one threat.
Yeah, and these changes in technology, we often don't realize the hazards to other species until the technology has been out there a while, and all of a sudden we discover, oh, gee, this is, why didn't we think of that? Well, we don't always think of that, but we've got to be aware of that. Another thing in the Midwest, around the nation, oil spills, now on land as well as on some of our rivers and streams, as more pipelines and train wrecks and more oil gets, again, it's just technological change. We can produce more of our own oil and not be so dependent on Middle Eastern oil. And yet the hazards are there not only for us, but for other wildlife species as well.
Jim, we have just about 30 seconds left. Where are your favorite places to watch migratory birds in Iowa?
Oh, I love the lakes here in central Iowa and the rivers as well. Those attract so many different species. And I will, as the spring goes on, I will visit some of our native prairies to pick up some of the songbirds that use our prairies as well. But lakes and rivers all over the state are fantastic as the spring moves forward.
All right, wildlife biologist Jim Pease, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Enjoy mud season.
Yes.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to find out about the Lost Cemetery of Dubuque, Iowa, a major archaeological project that has been undertaken over the last few years. We'll talk about that tomorrow. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.